Hey everybody, it's me, world famous comedian Tom Papa. Make sure you go to TomPapa.com for my upcoming tour dates and follow me on Facebook and Twitter at Tom Papa so we can take our relationship to the next level. You know, for the past year or so, I've been interviewing amazing comedians, directors, and all-around cool people for my show Come to Papa on SiriusXM. It's been an amazing experience, and I really urge you to subscribe to SiriusXM at SiriusXM.com so you can catch all the latest stuff we have going on over there. Today, I'd like to share with you my interview with the amazing Mel Brooks. I went to his office in LA and spent an hour with this comedy legend. It was truly one of those moments when you get home at night and you think, this is the greatest job in the world. So enjoy me and my new friend, Mel Brooks.
Come to Papa. Come see your Papa.
Ladies and germs,
yes.
Welcome to Come to Papa. I am Tom Papa, and I am crazy excited about today's show because my guest is the one and only Mel Brooks.
That's me.
Comedian, director, screenwriter, lyricist, actor, producer, one of the few entertainers
incredibly
to
old and incredibly short.
And adorable.
Don't leave that out, right.
One of the few entertainers to receive an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony.
And look behind me. There are a few others.
They're all
if
over
we
there.
Name them, you'd be out of your mind. Like, for instance, This is
in his office.
This is 2004, the Evening Standard Theater Awards. They happen to be prestigious, by the way.
That is nice.
From ITV London, Best Musical, The Producers.
Wow. What's that one with the microscope?
The one with the microscope. Okay, let me read some of these. In honor of your dear friend, Ed Victor, who's an agent, by the way.
Uh-huh.
He is my son, Max Brooks's agent.
Ah.
Max sells a lot of books.
Yeah, zombie books.
Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z. And Ed Victor, well, he handles a lot of, you know, big writers. We thank you for your passionate commitment to finding a cure for blood cancer. Your friends at the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, Greater Los Angeles chapter.
That sounds funny.
Yeah, everybody picks, you know, everybody picks something, some charity, and in 1999, 2000, I was working with a wonderful guy called Mike Okrent, who did for me and my gal on Broadway, and he also did Crazy for You, and he was a sensational Broadway musical director, starting in the West End, an English guy. And married to Susan Stroman, the great choreographer.
Right.
And things were fine, and then suddenly, boom.
Oh, man.
He died of leukemia.
Jeez Louise.
So anytime I get a chance to help, cure that.
Yeah, yeah.
And Ed Victor, who's the agent, has the long, long form, the form where you could live. There's an acute form that it kills you pretty soon.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
And then there's a where you can kind of journey on for a while.
Yeah, I had a friend who had it, and he was in bad shape for about a year and a half, and then now he's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Ed is in remission, so we're very happy.
Oh, that's great. Theater, where you started out. I mean, you started out.
You know, it's an incredible arc.
Yeah.
I started out really in television with Sid Caesar.
Right, your show of shows.
And then very early, I think we started in 50, 51. In 52, I did my first Broadway show, which was New Faces of 1952, and I did some sketches and stuff.
Right,
just together with Ronnie Graham, who was the MC and the writer. And
were you writer or producer?
I was just writing sketches. Just a writer.
Right,
and Sheldon Harnick wrote an incredible, funny song for Alice Ghostly in that called The Boston Begin.
Uh-huh.
It happened in Boston in the native quarter. I mean, it was a really very funny stuff.
Right.
And New Faces was a review, and reviews would open on Friday and close on Saturday, and this one ran for close to 2 years. So
oh, wow.
It was,
Wow.
It was a winning review.
And did that happen just because you were in New York doing your shows and you just slid down to Broadway?
I was in New York, and there was one of Eddie Cantor's daughters, Marilyn, was doing a review.
Right.
In those days, people did reviews.
Yeah.
And she was heading for Broadway, took it to Philadelphia. It was called Curtain Going Up. It never did. It never did. But there was my sketch, a satire of fathers. It was called Fathers and Sons, and it was like a takeoff of Willie Loman and Death of a Salesman.
Oh, that's funny.
And it was pretty good, funny. And Leonard Sillman, who did the various New Faces.
Right.
In 37, he did New Faces of 37 with Imogen Coca, Henry Fonda. I mean, you know, he discovered a lot of people.
Wow.
In our New Faces, we had Carol Lawrence, Virginia Deluce, Robert Clary, who was on Stalag. No, what the hell? He was on
Hogan's Heroes.
He was the Frenchman on Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, the French, yeah.
Robert Clary, good singer, good dancer.
Yeah.
Ronnie Graham,
Paul Lynde,
Eartha Kitt. I mean,
oh my God!
Yeah, but look at
these are the new faces in 1 year.
Knew all of these people in 1 year.
Wow!
So it was a terrific,
amazing
idea to get these new faces.
Were you aware when you were doing shows when you were in that writers' room with Carl Reiner and Neil Simon and all these guys? Did you realize that you were really fortunate, or is only until when you were looking back did you realize how special that was?
That's a good question and a good answer, because it was really only looking back that one ever realizes what was happening during the show. You know?
During the show, you're just like, this guy's always late.
Yeah, late.
This guy chews funny.
Yeah. And I was always late, and they pinned me against the wall once. Actually, I was really late, and Carl Reiner paid $25 for a bagel and coffee. And it normally is $1.25, right?
Right.
So, but he gave the guy $1. He tipped him $20 or something, you know, and just to teach me a lesson. He said, that'll cost you $25 because you're late. And everybody attacked me, and they said nobody can come up. They were stuck with a carrot joke. It's Sid and Imogen. He's eating carrots, and we need a carrot joke, and everybody's no good carrot jokes yet. I said, well, give me a minute, literally, you know.
Right.
And I said, okay, I got it. She said, what's your carrot joke? I said, the carrot joke is this guy ate so many carrots he couldn't sleep. Why? Because he saw through his eyelids. And, you know, that's
funny.
I mean, I assume that people knew the carrots were good for your eyes.
Right, good for your eyes. Right.
So anyway, but the show.
So how many years were you working there? And this is your first gig, really?
Yeah,
your first real writing.
It was about 9 or 10 years. I mean,
wow. So by the time you came out, you were sharp.
I knew. Well,
yeah.
During that time, Carl and I were shaping up and sharpening the 2,000-year-old man.
Right.
Never realizing that in 1960 we'd actually make a record and it would be a hit. You know.
Amazing. It's amazing how long it's still really funny today. I mean, someone gave me just as a gift the CD box set of it just like a year ago. I mean, they're still selling it, still
out
there.
Yeah, no, there's a company called The Shout Factory.
Right.
And they do wonderful box sets like Gary Shandling, you know.
Right.
He did Larry Sanders. The season, they boxed it, and it's great.
It's amazing.
And they just did the late, great Ernie Kovacs.
Beautiful.
And that's selling. And so they do these wonderful box sets, and they're actually doing one with me called The History of Mel Brooks Part 1. So,
oh, really?
So I'm gathering stuff.
Oh, wow.
And that's one of the reasons I did a Dick Cavett.
Yes. Called Mel Brooks and Dick Cavett Together Again.
Yeah, and some of it is very funny, and some of it is just lame and stupid. But that's what happens with every show. You know, some things are dumb. He's astonishingly gentile, so he's not always funny and awake, you know. But I'm right. I'm always there, you know.
Right.
I'm right there.
You're doing your part.
Yeah, yeah. Now, It was a good idea. He was selling a book, and he asked me to join him at the Wilshire Theater, now known as the Saban Theater. And so I joined him on stage, and it turned out to be, you know, I said, well, look, I'm doing this box set for Shout.
Right.
So I said, Steve, that's the first name of Steve Haberman, who wrote... He wrote a lot of stuff. He wrote a wonderful, a funny thing with Rudy DeLuca called, wait a minute, Dracula Dead and Loving It and Life Stinks. These guys wrote some very funny stuff.
Yeah,
and he's a born director, natural director. So I said, Haberman. He said, yes. I said, wait a minute. Let me think of what I want to talk to you about. Get some cameras. Get one on me, one on Dick. And get it. Another camera for a two-shot,
right.
and cover the audience, because I'm sure Carl Reiner will turn up once he knows
right.
we're going to be there.
Right.
And so get one for the audience of anybody who's is cute, or maybe just audience reaction.
Right.
And you know, so get these four cameras.
Oh, that's great.
And cover it for the Mel Brooks, you know, box set. You
know?
So I didn't know. So here we are, Dick and I talk, and we play vocal ping pong in some kind of... You know, showbiz badinage, if
right,
you will, you know,
right.
talking about, did you know Jack Benny? Yes,
right.
I have a Jack Benny joke. You know,
right.
Did you know Jerry Lewis? I worked for him. Did you, you know?
Right.
And we tell all, you know, we just kept telling some, strangely enough, he did the belly laughs and the dirty stuff.
Oh, really?
And I was much more, you know, the professor talking about show business.
Interesting.
But I got in a few, I mean...
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
And one of the things I did was really funny.
Yeah.
Do you remember Bill Cullen with the glasses and the crew cut? And
no.
He did so many game shows. He was the
host. Okay. No.
He did a show called, this guy Bill Cullen, sweetest guy that ever lived. He did a show called I Guess. And then, I don't know what the show was, and then Julia Mead was my partner, you know, I Guess.
Right.
But playing this game, and he's behind this little dais, this little... stand with his script, and and at the end of the show, I had no idea because I've never seen him, you know.
Yeah.
Before the show, we didn't say hello, we just did the show.
Right.
And then at the end of the show, he leaves this little platform he was behind, this little dais, and he walks toward me, and I thought he was doing Jerry Lewis, and Julia Mead yelled at me. Because I was imitating. He was doing it.
You were imitating.
He was doing, you know, splaying his legs and walking so crazy. And I figured, well, he's doing Jerry Lewis. I'll do Jerry. So I walked crazy toward him. And Julia Mead is yelling, no, he's crippled. And he had polio. Mel, stop. And I yelled back, too late. You know? And I was doing this crazy crippled walk, you know. We got to the middle of the stage and he hugged me and he was crying. And I said, well, you know, what's that? He said, nobody ever had the nerve to make fun of, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Being crippled, yeah.
That's the greatest.
I said, I had to do it for you, you know.
Yeah.
No idea.
No clue.
No clue. Oh, God. Most embarrassing moment of my life.
Oh,
you know?
Really?
Right. That and doing this show. But otherwise, you know.
This is right up there.
I make a joke, Tom. Yeah.
It's pretty funny, like, when you look at all of your comedy, because it's, you kind of do that. It's, you take something like polio.
Yeah,
I mean, here you didn't really know.
Well,
it,
I didn't.
But
I didn't intend to.
I know you didn't. But in with all your other subjects, like in Blazing Saddles, there was racism. Young Frankenstein, there was the horrible injustice to monsters. But the producers in all Nazi Germany.
It's
I mean, you really
justice
take really heavy.
Justice to monsters. I love that.
You take really, yeah. But you do. Yeah. Is there a part of you that is using comedy as a weapon, or are you just trying to be silly with it?
There is no philosophical basis for it. I mean, it's normal. I just respond. That's all. I mean, you know.
Right.
And all my life, I've always seen the bizarre, ridiculously funny side of event and life. And so, you know, I usually come up with some wacky, you know, funny thing. Hopefully funny. You know?
Yeah. But it's interesting because there is definitely that thing. Because again, this is kind of similar to looking back at the show.
One of the reasons I'm loving to do the show is because I love George Shapiro, who's one of your producers.
Right, right, yeah.
And,
I love George.
And George got my son Max Brooks his first big job as one of the writers of Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And Max worked on it for two seasons, and then he wrote this zombie survival guide.
Yeah.
And then, you know, took a different direction.
Yeah.
Know?
Sold and a lot of books.
He sold, you know what, you know, the mistake, it's pretty weird. He wrote the zombie survival guide, and everybody thought, well, this is a Saturday Night Live writer, so it's obviously tongue-in-cheek.
Right.
You know, what he doesn't really care about zombies, right. You know. But he does.
He
cares more about zombies and how to protect yourself, and it's all real. And so the book, the zombie book, the zombie survival guide was limping along
right.
in the humor section. So Max suggested to Borders, I think it was it.
Right.
Why don't you move it? Take it out of the humor section and move it to the horror, sci-fi, you know.
Right.
Because those are my people.
Right.
So they said, well, okay, at one store. Well, they sold out. And then they called the other store. They all sold out. They kept selling out until finally he sold a million copies. Because they moved it to the sci-fi horror set, you know.
That's great.
And it's never stopped. And then he followed it up. He followed it up with another book called World War Z. Brad Pitt read the book, he loved it, and bought it for his Plan B company.
Oh, wow.
And folks, if you hear me, if you hear some strange lip sounds and stuff like that, I've just come from the dentist.
Yes.
He's paralyzed half half of my mouth, and I'm doing a brilliant job making believe that I'm talking.
Out of just that one corner. Did you know he was a funny kid? Was he funny as a
kid?
Yeah,
he was always, you know, dry. I didn't know whether he meant it or not. That's how, yet he was a funny, he was a pretty funny kid.
Right.
And then, but he had this incredible talent that I never had.
Right.
For narrative, for description, for, you know, and he would break down things on every basis. You know, if you read World War Z, it's a brilliant, a text on government. Why government? Who runs government?
Right.
Why zombies could take over a country?
Right.
Because people who are running government really don't care about the country. They care about getting elected.
Right.
So
right.
It's an amazing treatise.
Oh,
you
that's
know?
Amazing.
I'm,
yeah.
I'm very really proud of him.
Oh, that's great.
Anyway, it's going to be. It's. I'm sure Brad Pitt is going to release it.
Right.
Whatever. But I think Paramount had a date.
Okay, awesome.
They had a date, and I think the date was Christmas 2012, you know, 2012.
Right, right. Oh, great.
So
you're listening to Come to Papa. I am Tom Papa, and I'm here today with my new pal, the one and only Mel Brooks. When you, producers was your, no, I saw your short film that you won an Oscar for, by the way.
I saw The Marriage Rep.
The Critic.
I keep seeing your show. I like it. Well, I love George Shapiro, who's one of the producers, and I own a lot, so I feel it's my bounden duty to watch this crazy show. So Carl and I watch it. We watch it every week.
That's great and embarrassing. George was telling me that one of his first deals as an agent was getting the animated version of 2000-Year-Old Man sold.
He did. He sold it to CBS. It was amazing.
Amazing. That was like his first.
Yeah.
You didn't write 2000-Year-Old. You just improvised it?
It wrote itself.
It wrote itself.
It started with, we were in the writer's room, and he came up to me with a microphone, and he said, did you know this, ladies and gentlemen, I can't believe it, but the Mayo Clinic has testified to the fact that this man is actually 2,000 years old. I didn't know.
And you had never heard
I'd
this.
Never heard this before.
That's so funny.
And he said to me, 2,000 years old, sir, did you know Jesus? I said, yeah. Thin lad, sandals, right? Walked around with 12 other guys, came in the store, never bought anything. They just asked for water. You know? And then I just, and that was it.
And just, and that's how you guys would that just riff it. Like that all the time.
And then he would ask, and so it kind of actually wrote itself.
Amazing. And did you perform it live at all, or was it, did you just
record
it?
Always, We always did it live. We did it live for 10 years before Steve Allen said, you've got to record it.
Oh, that's hilarious. But live in front of an audience everywhere you went?
Live in front of other writers, live in front
just
of a,
at parties,
you know.
Really? I mean, you know, for 10 years?
For money. You know, they wouldn't just give for us fun. Money, but they would give us food, and, you know.
Right.
And it was great. You'd get, you know, and except for salmon salad, everything was great. The salmon salad had onions. I don't want to talk about the salmon salad, please. But there was Joe Fields gave a party, and the main dish was salmon salad. It was the worst night of my life.
Sounds terrible. We've really been through some tragedy. What was worse, World War II or that? The salmon salad.
Honestly, World War II. I got to be honest with you. But the salmon salad was like close on its heels. It was a close second for a disaster for me personally. You know, I actually was in World War II.
I'm
old enough that I had 3.5 months of combat.
Really?
Combat. Ducking. You know, it's either combat or, you know. I'm lucky. I cursed my family and my mother in genealogy because I was short, but I blessed her during World War II.
Right, you just
most of the bullets went over my head. You know, it was great.
How old were you when you were in World War II?
18. 18 and a half, 19.
Wow. And when you came back, were you funnier or were you less funny?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I think I was... It took a while. I worked in the mountains when I was 16 and 17 as a drummer, comic.
Right.
Busboy, whatever it was, you know.
Yeah.
And I went back to Grossinger's.
Oh, you did?
After the war.
Right.
And I got a job, you know, as being part of the social staff.
Right, right.
And that, you know, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I met a girl who was so thin. Oh, this girl was skinny, I got to tell you. This was a skinny girl. I took her to a restaurant. The maitre d' said, check your umbrella. That's how skinny this girl is. But I want to tell you, it was so crowded, you know.
Right.
The jokes were so bad that I began writing my own jokes, and that led me to Sid Caesar. I met Sid Caesar in the mountains. Earlier in my career, I was at the Butler Lodge in Hurleyville, and he was at the Avon Lodge, not too far from Liberty. Uh-huh. And he played tenor sax and was kind of on the social staff.
Oh, wow.
And so we kind of knew each other, you know, respected each other. I was a drummer, and he was...
Wow.
And I thought, you know, we would jam together as a drummer and a tenor. I never dreamt that we'd ever jam together as the best comic in America and a comedy writer.
Yeah, you know? That's crazy.
So anyway, it was all because of a guy called Don Appel, who was an actor, director, writer. He wrote a beautiful play called This Too Shall Pass about anti-Semitism.
Right.
And he also was the producer of the Vaughn Monroe Show. Racing with the Moon. You ever hear that song?
Yeah.
It's 100 years old. It was Vaughn Monroe's biggest and only hit.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he had his own little TV show, and Don was the producer of that. But Don knew everybody. He knew Sid.
Right.
And he knew me
right.
from Williamsburg. And so, I mean, because of Don Appel, I got to meet Sid, and, you know, and it all worked out.
So what were you doing while you were writing The Producers? Because The Producers was your first film, right?
I was writing Get Smart.
Oh, you
were. I had created Get Smart with Buck Henry, and I was fooling around with Get Smart, and I was on the side dabbling in this. I used to work for a guy, I can't tell you his name. Not because I don't know it. It's because he has grandchildren. And I wouldn't.
Uh-huh.
But he used to screw little old ladies on a cracked leather couch. And they'd give him money.
Right.
And every show he did was a flop. But he would always raise $2,000 or $3,000 more than he needed. And he'd live on that. But he never made a killing like Max Bialystock in my you know.
Play. I never knew that was a true story.
But it's a true story.
Oh, that's crazy.
And he wore an alpaca coat. And he wore a derby stained, chicken stains.
God.
Chicken fat stains on his kind of Hamburg, not a derby, a Hamburg.
Right.
And he was a great guy. And, you know, and he would do shows. He would present. He did shows like, do you ever remember a Spanish or a Mexican song writer, singer called Tito Gazzar?
Right.
Yeah, and he was kind of famous, and he would present him at town hall, and I would run around to barbershops with cards. Tito Gazzar coming Wednesday, you know? And they'd see me come and say, get out of here, kid, you know?
You
I'd say, please
shows.
Put one in the window. I won't get my salary. All right. You know?
Right.
So,
Wow. So,
and I worked for this guy, and he
So you always
and
had
so
him
the
in
scheme
your head.
Was he'd raise just a little more than the show cost,
right.
So that he could. And he lived in his office. He had a coffee pot, you know, and
same
a,
thing.
You know, a toaster. You know, he had a,
So was he big and blustery like Zero Mostel?
He was big.
Yeah.
He was big.
Yeah.
He was a con man, and you know.
Was it hard to get that film financed?
Impossible.
I mean, because they wouldn't distribute it, which I just learned. I didn't realize that it was hard to get a distributor for it because it was so
well. I mean, we went
racy at the time.
We went everywhere, and finally, there was a guy called Sidney Glazer, G-L-A-Z-I-E-R. Sidney Glazer had done an award-winning documentary, The Eleanor Roosevelt Story, beautiful,
right.
And he just. There was an agent called Barry Levinson, not to be confused with the guy who wrote with me and Rudy when we were writing High Anxiety.
Right.
The great Barry Levinson.
Yeah.
This was an agent.
Uh-huh.
And Barry Levinson knew Sidney, and he knew me, and he knew the script, and he said, give it to Sidney. So I brought it to Sidney, and he said, read it. He was eating on whole wheat with tomato, a tuna fish sandwich, and a malted, a milkshake.
Right.
And he said, read it. I said, read it. I'll leave it here. You'll read it if you like it. You know.
Right.
He said, no, I don't have the time. Read it. Read it to me. So I began reading, and when I came to Springtime for Italy, he spit the tuna fish out and the malt, and he fell down behind his desk. I said, yeah, I've killed this guy. Oh, my God.
Right.
Yeah, I've killed him with comedy. But,
right.
You know, but
great.
Then when he got up, he said, he spit a little more, and he said, we're going to make this movie. We're going to get this movie made.
Wow.
And he went to everybody. He took me to Universal, and the people at Universal said, it's very funny. It's very good, and we like it. But Hitler too much. Hitler is a bit much. How about if you change it to Mussolini, who's kind of accepted as a dictator, we'll make it. I said, but you don't get it.
Yeah,
it's
got
to close in one night. With Mussolini, it's liable to run. You know?
Yeah, people might like it.
So we couldn't use Universal. So we went from one place to another.
Wow.
And finally, Joseph E. Levine, AFCO Embassy Pictures, a bit of a genius.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was. Joseph E. Levine did A Bridge Too Far. And when a wonderful movie.
Yeah.
And when A Bridge Too Far opened, he was personally $2 million in the black because he was a little like Bialystok. He raised more than he needed for this picture.
Right.
And so there was no failing. AFCO Embassy wasn't failing. And it turned out to be a good picture and made some money anyway.
Right.
And but he did The Lion in Winter. He did A Man for All Seasons. I mean, he did amazing movies.
Wow.
He did The Graduate.
Oh, geez.
That was Joseph E. Levine who did The Graduate. And he did The Producers.
I mean, Holy cow.
But what kept him going, kept him alive, was Hercules Unchained. You know, these kind of Italian Western legend wacko movies. But everybody went to see them, and that's what paid for his office.
That's so funny.
But he was incredibly had eclectic taste. I mean, you know.
Can you tell me?
Hercules Unchained, then Hercules Chained Again, then Hercules Almost Chained, but he got away. I mean, he did about four Hercules, you know, with variations on whether he was chained or not chained. You know?
Hilarious.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, about this? Was that the first time you worked with Gene Wilder? Was it at The Producers? Because then you went on to Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, it was The Producers, but
Was Producers the first one?
My wife was doing a Bertolt Brecht play.
Right.
That Jerry Robbins was directing.
The Lovely Anne Bancroft.
Yeah. And she was so good.
Yeah.
So great. And,
amazing.
And every possible you know, way good mommy, good everything. And she was doing Mother Courage. She was playing the lead, Mother Courage. And there was the smaller part, it was part of a chaplain who, and it was Gene Wilder. And, you know, it's kind of a, you know, semi-serious play.
Right.
And Gene would come off stage, and I was the one, I met him, I liked him, we were in the wings talking, you know. And
right.
I said, one day you're going to be working, you know, and he said, yeah, that'll be the day.
Uh-huh.
But he kept saying, why are they laughing at me? I said, because you're funny.
He didn't know
he was
funny.
Your mannerisms, your voice, you're just naturally funny.
Right.
He said, I don't mean to be. I said, that's up to God. It's not up to you.
Right.
You know, God says, you are funny, that's it. You know, you better buy it. So he became my friend.
Right.
And we had a little house in Fire Island. He'd often come out and I'd be working on the producers, and I'd say, "Here, this is the latest scene I wrote." And he'd love it and encourage me. And
wow.
I said, "One day you'll be Leo Bloom."
Wow.
And he said, "Well, if you ever get to make it, they won't take me. They're going to take somebody with a name, you know."
Right.
And he had replaced Alan Arkin in a show, Murray Siskal comedy on Broadway called Love.
Uh-huh.
And he was backstage. We had seen the show. He was so good in it. And we came backstage, and I threw the script, and I said, "It's going to be made, and you're Leo Bloom." And he began to cry.
No, really?
Yeah, he hugged me, and he was just,
oh, my God.
Tears pouring out.
Oh,
and he said,
man.
"I don't believe it," you know.
That's amazing.
And so
a find.
Yeah.
What a find.
Yeah.
So just because he was doing it in a serious role.
He was in a serious role. He was getting laughs, and he had such a delicious, funny way about him. He was so unique.
So unique.
And he saved my life time after time. Like, I got to tell you, a terrible story and a funny story.
Uh-huh.
I'm doing the first day of shooting on the movie Blazing Saddles.
Right.
I got Cleavon Little, and he's terrific. I wanted Richard Pryor, but
you wrote it with Richard, right?
I wrote it with Richard. I had Richard in mind to play the black sheriff, but they wouldn't take him. I mean, maybe
the studio wouldn't take him.
No, they said we know he does drugs. He's not. Yeah, 2 years later, he was the biggest thing in movies.
Oh my God!
They made some mistake, but anyway.
Jeez.
So I saw, but I took a good bounce because I saw a lot of people, and I found Cleavon Little, who was just beautiful.
Great.
He was so great. So there's Cleavon Little,
right.
and there's the jail cell scene,
uh-huh.
and I had hired Dig Young, who's a brilliant actor. They shoot horses, don't they? He won an Academy Award for that.
Wow.
And he was brilliant, and he was an ex-drinker, an alcoholic.
Uh-huh.
So I said, "This is perfect, because the Waco kid's an alcoholic. This is great."
Right.
So I say, "Action." Okay, so... the black sheriff, Cleavon, says, "Are we awake?" And then he says, the Waco kid, look, he's upside down, hanging from his bed.
Right.
And he looks at him and says, "I don't know, are we black?" You know? And he says, And I say, "Wait a minute." I said, "This guy's really giving it everything. This ex-alcoholic, look, he's drooling. Look, oh my God." You know, I said to my assistant director, you know, "He's foaming. My God, what a great actor. He's foaming at the mouth and he's drooling. Oh, now he's spitting green vomit."
Oh, no.
"No, he's giving me too much, you know."
Oh, no.
And then we called an ambulance and we took him away.
Oh, no.
And he never, you know, he
never came back.
He never came back. He was a recovering alcoholic who never really recovered.
And, it's terrible.
And his manager wanted to sue me for firing him, you know.
Oh, geez.
So I called Gene that night. That was a Friday. We started shooting on a Friday for some reason that, you know.
Yeah.
And Gene was set to do The Little Prince. He had a part, a really important.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, "Gene, what am I going to do? You know, shut down shooting." And
right.
He said, "Well, it's such a great movie. It's a great, great comedy." He said, "You're saying something about race." He said,
right.
"This is an important." He said, "Wait a minute, I'll call you back." So I don't know who he called, but he got them to delay his part. The shooting in Ireland of The Little Prince, and he got a 6 week delay.
Oh wow!
And he called me back and he said, "I'll do Jim. I'll do the Waco kid."
Wow!
So
that's a brilliant.
And he flew out the next day.
Jesus.
Tried on the costume, met a horse, he loved the horse. I said, "What about?" He knew this. I mean, he could just.
Yeah.
Inhale. Two guys
could
inhale a script, read it once and have it, never have to memorize it. It was
really?
In their heads. Frank Langella.
Yeah.
And Gene Wilder.
Really?
They just
immediately have it all.
They had it all. They had, they had all the other parts too.
How freaky.
Just in case. You know?
Yeah, right.
So anyway, and he stepped in and I was so
brilliant.
Lucky. What a bounce that was.
So brilliant.
Because, I mean, had I gotten a serious actor to do
it,
it would have put a little bit of a pall on. It would have been a little too serious.
Yeah, a little
heavy.
Right.
And Gene gave it both.
Right.
He gave it its gravitas, if you will, and he gave it its wacky, loony comedy, you know?
He's so naturally light.
Yeah.
Right?
So he
And what's weird about him, and for me, you directing other great, I mean, the list of great comedic actors that you worked with is crazy. But the thing with Gene, and I always hear him saying in interviews, that he would never try and play anything funny. He would always just play it as honest as he could.
Right.
And it just came out.
And it came out funny.
It
right.
was so funny.
I never told him to be funny.
Right.
The only direction I ever gave him is I said, you're a little loud in this scene, and you were loud in the last scene.
Right.
So you don't want to be orange all the time. Let's have a little purple here, you know.
Right,
that's
right.
all. That's all I ever said to him. That scene, and he knew just what to do.
That scene of the producers when Zero's slapping him and he's hysterical, and he throws water on him. I'm wet, and I'm hysterical. I'm in pain.
Yeah, right. Every beat. Couldn't, you know.
And you wrote all that.
I wrote every minute of it.
Every bit of it. Man, oh man.
And they didn't both, I got to say this, I've done many movies where the actors say, yeah, could I say this, or can we change this, or could we do?
Yeah.
But with Zero and Gene, not a word.
Not a word.
They never.
Wow.
They loved every line they had, and it was just great.
Were you confident that you had such a good script?
But I'd written comedy for 10 years on the show, so I knew what would get laughs,
you were sharp.
What was funny.
But that's a big leap, though, to go from sketch in that show and then
Because on the show of shows, we had a live audience. So what I usually do with a movie, I have a rough cut, which is longer than I need. Always 10 or 20 minutes longer than I need in the movie. And I show it to audiences over different audiences. I'll go to a little town, or I'll bring them into 20th Century Fox, into the little theater. And the audience will always cut it for me. They'll tell me they'll cut it even to the point of where they cough, it's no good, or where they sigh, and it's good.
Right.
And that doesn't always have to be laughs.
Right.
If they go, you hear that? You hear a consensus. You hear a collective. They like it. They like that moment.
What's so great about all your films is that they're so packed with jokes. You don't go a long period of time.
Right. You know that was TV training.
Uh-huh.
You only had so many minutes.
Right.
And you had a score.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Like you had to get a laugh every minute or every minute and a half.
And
I knew it was in somewhere printed and imprinted in my head, you know.
Because those jokes, they really go forever. Yeah. You know, it's funny because when I was a kid, my father took me to see History of the World, Part 1, and it was, you know, I was just starting to become funny, and then you're in this theater and you're watching Gregory Hines with that gigantic joint, and you're seeing the thing with the eunuchs, and you coming in as the comedian, and it was an amazing comedy education.
But you know, when I was writing it, I knew.
Uh-huh.
When I was writing the script, I knew I better do 1,000 jokes because 500 won't work.
Right.
You know.
For all your
films? Every film I wrote too many comedy scenes or comedy sketches or comedy moments.
Right.
And I was always right because a third of them died the death of a dog. They never got the laugh I expected, you know.
Right.
Or the audience wasn't ready for them or there wasn't enough valley of information to make the big peak work.
Explain that. Know? What do you mean?
Because you just can't say, and she fell on her ass.
Right.
You can't. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, it, so who?
Right.
Why? You know?
Okay.
So this lovely lady, a little stout, was eating a banana. So she peeled one side, she peeled the other, and not even thinking, threw the banana peel down on the floor. Well, somebody called her in the wrong or the right direction. She took that step and she fell on her ass. But you need, see how much you need before she fell on her ass?
Right.
You need a nice, quiet little setup. I call them the valleys.
That's
funny.
It's a funny way of thinking, though, because it's funny that you would have to think about the valleys because you're so joke heavy, because you're always thinking about jokes.
Yeah.
It's almost like the opposite of the struggles a lot of other people have, which is their whole thing is valleys, and they're trying to get jokes in there.
But if late at night you're at a comedy store or something with other comics, you just say, and the gun didn't work. I mean, you know what I mean? You don't even, there's no setups. You just, it's like comedy ping pong.
Yeah, shorthand.
You just bang punchlines at each other.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Did you have influence in film from were there comedic film actors or that you
oh yeah
aspire to?
Well, physically, I mean, I had geniuses like Chaplin and like Buster Keaton and like Harold Lloyd.
Right.
And, you know, even W.C. Fields. I mean, they would even Laurel and Hardy. I mean.
So funny.
The ones I liked the best were teams.
Uh-huh.
The Marx Brothers I liked the best.
Right.
Or the Ritz Brothers. I love the Ritz. You ever hear of the Ritz Brothers? The Ritz Brothers were three guys, Harry in the middle, Al on the left, and Jimmy on the right. It says Harry, Al, and Jimmy, and they were the Ritz Brothers, and they were the comedy relief in the 20th Century Fox, like, musicals, like Sonia Henie.
Right.
Sonia Henie skating, you know, musicals with John Payne being the leading man. Right. And when you needed comedy, they either had Borominovich and his harmonica rascals, or they had the Ritz Brothers. I mean,
just throw them in.
And so I really fell in love with those teams, you know.
Right. Amazing. And so when you would watch those guys, and even thinking now, like, because you went so far into the future of comedy, what are the basic things that you would see in like a Buster Keaton film that would hold true all the way through? Because there's
there are certain things like Buster Keaton was very brave. He was not afraid to be still or to wait.
Right.
He waited quietly for the right moment, and then all hell broke loose.
Right.
But you know, he wasn't panicked that 2 minutes would go by, and he was just looking, you know, he'd look from side to side.
Right.
He just knew. Same.
Yeah.
Harold Lloyd had that kind of thing, too. Chaplin didn't have the patience.
Right.
You know, he didn't wait a long time, except in serious moments, like in City Lights.
Yeah.
You know, with the flower and the girl.
Right,
he could be very...
Yeah, sweet.
But what ideas, Chaplin, he's walking, and we see a truck go by, and a red flag, you assume it's a load of wood, and the flag falls off the truck, so it's one of those red flags.
Truck.
So, well, he picks it up, and he looks at it, and then there's a lot of people running behind him. He doesn't know what they're running for, so he runs.
Right.
And, you know, so he's a communist leader. He's got the red flag, and the world is chasing him.
Right.
And, you know, everybody's ready to kill him.
Yeah.
I mean, just concepts, you know. Yeah. He was so
pretty
brilliant, you know.
Yeah.
And he really did the skating, the roller skating in the big store.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just amazing.
Oh, that scene when he's dancing, when he kicks his leg out.
Right.
And just goes all the way
around.
And
what about the Gold Rush? I mean, the amazing physical things he did in the Gold Rush with that house tilting over.
But what is it? What is it about? Because at a comedy club I work in New York, the Comedy Cellar, they play Chaplin 24 hours a day. It's just always running in a loop on this big screen.
Oh, that's great.
And kids, like I'll bring my kids in or I'll see other kids when I'm working. And this is the restaurant upstairs of the comedy club. And all these... This
What's
is
the restaurant upstairs?
Was the Olive Tree.
Olive Tree.
Olive Tree.
I know
this. Israeli restaurant.
Yeah, right.
And Manny Dwarman owned it. And and then downstairs is the comedy club. But I mean, it's 2011.
Yeah.
And there's kids
and
old
get
people.
It.
And they get it.
They get it.
They're glued to it and they get
I
it.
I love it.
But yet certain other comedies don't hold up like that.
There were comedies in the middle that silent movie comedies, many of which didn't work.
Uh-huh.
And then later, in the early talkies, there were mixtures of serious social comment and comedy, like Preston Sturges, Palm Beach Story,
right,
or Sullivan's
Travels.
I mean, there were wonderful mixtures
of
social comment and all out. You know, fall down comedies.
Right.
You know,
right.
I loved Preston Sturges. And then I think Billy Wilder learned an awful lot
from Preston Sturges.
From Preston Sturges. Because Billy Wilder was a bit of a genius.
Right. Right.
He put a lot of stuff together.
Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
I used to go to lunch with him.
Oh, yeah?
He thought I was good. He said, Blazing Saddles is remarkable. You know, and he.
Really?
You know, coming from Billy Wilder.
Oh, my God.
That was remarkable.
Yeah.
So. Mike Gruskoff, who produced Young Frankenstein and My Favorite Year for me and my company.
Yeah, you produced that, right?
I produced that.
Right.
We would take Billy Wilder to lunch once or twice a week.
Wow.
And we'd take him to the grill.
Really?
He liked soft-shell crab. And, you know, he was getting on in years, and, you know, he was having little gaps and little, you know, weights in his thinking and stuff.
Yeah.
But I try to point out in his movies what I thought was really genius creative, and, and I would point it out, and he'd say, "You got that, you got that." You
know? Oh, really?
Yeah, because it wasn't one of the, you know, peaks or valleys. It was in between.
Right,
you know,
but
the ideas were so brilliant.
Wow, amazing. And when you went on to, there's a movie poster up behind you here in your office for The Elephant Man. And I heard that this is why you just developed Brooks Films, because if it said Mel Brooks, people would think it was a joke. Is that true?
Yeah, they would. It would be, you know, Pavlovian, you know.
Right.
You ring the bell, the dog salivates.
Right.
You say Mel Brooks, they're ready to laugh.
Right.
So Mel Brooks is a dangerous name.
It's great.
And that's what held me. Woody did it, but Woody wasn't that famous. He wasn't that well known as just a laugh riot when he was doing Annie Hall, which was semi-serious.
Right.
So he was allowed to do interiors or whatever, or Match Point.
Right,
crime and
misdemeanors.
Crime and misdemeanors. Yeah. He was allowed because they would take it. They'd say, you know, and this was wonderful because he's as good, serious filmmaker as he is, you know, a comedy. You know, he's terrific.
Yeah.
But I wasn't allowed because I had done Blazing Saddles and, you know.
Young Frankenstein.
You know, crazy movies. And, and High Anxiety. I was not allowed. I was simply not allowed to do serious movies.
Yeah. Did you feel, frustrated by that? Or
I was frustrated.
You were, really?
Because
you have it in you.
Because you see it in Young Frankenstein, what a hell of a director I am, you know.
Right.
Backlighting every, you know.
Yeah.
The cameras trundling in.
I mean,
technically, it's a gem of a movie.
It really is.
Really. Technically. It's, just the lighting.
It's beautiful.
And the performances. And I never... The only one I couldn't control was Marty Feldman.
Oh, really?
I gave up. I said, all right, do what the hell you want. You know, you're too
good. The two broads joke.
Yeah,
when he attacks the...
Oh, yeah. When he starts biting, he bites
the head off of her mink stole.
He did that. I had no idea he would do that.
Oh, really?
But I did write, you take the blonde, I'll take the one in the turban.
Right,
I did. Yeah, I did write. And he did. He read it. Turban.
Yeah, he said turban with that New York accent. So brilliant.
Oh, Jesus.
Where did you find him?
Gene found him. I actually met him maybe 7 or 8 years before that. I was in England, and there was a Marty Feldman comedy machine, and it was written by Larry, the great, late Larry Gelbart.
Oh, really?
And I was in England, and Larry called me, and he said, come to Pine, whatever, I want to show you.
Uh-huh.
And I saw the show, and I said...
It was a live show?
Yeah. Yeah, with an audience and everything. And I said to Larry, don't fix his eyes. Whatever you do, don't fix his eyes. You know, and to this day, when I was working with Marty, the only way I could hide from Marty Feldman was to put my nose against his, because he would see out the sides. He never could see straight ahead, you know. So I mean...
What a comedy gold as a director.
You know, have
a
comedy gold. I hate actors. I hate being with them. They're selfish. They're egotistical. I mean, they're shitheads. They really... I hate them. And I'm one of them. Sorry. But... On Young Frankenstein, one of the few pictures, I demanded that we all have lunch together every day.
Uh-huh.
Because we'd have stories and, you know.
Right, right.
And I just
Because you just like that crew.
I just, Madeline Kahn.
Oh, my God.
Cloris Leachman. She was a pain in the ass, and she was great.
Oh, so funny.
And I loved Marty and Gene and Peter Boyle. I mean, look at these people.
God.
And we all sat around trading stories and,
You know. How were you, just had an eye to put together these casts.
Yeah, I knew.
Right?
I just knew
what funny was.
I got to give some credit to Mike Medavoy, who's now a big producer, and he ran TriStar Pictures for a while. He's a wonderful manager, agent, and now in those days, he was a wonderful agent.
Right.
And he handled Gene Wilder, Peter Boyle, and Marty Feldman.
Really?
So through Mike, I got all three of them.
And what's amazing about that cast, I mean, Cloris Leachman, too, and like we were saying earlier about Gene, these are just solid actors. Oh, they could do...
Every one of them is an actor.
Right. They're not comedians.
They're all, every one of them strangely enough, I hate to say it, but they're all intellectuals. They really are smart and bright. And they all, if you got to Marty's trailer, he'd always be reading Nabokov or Dostoevsky. Always interested.
Yeah.
There was a German writer that, I don't know whether.
Günter Grass?
Yeah, no, I think, yeah. No, it was, he kept reading him all the time.
Right.
And Schiller.
Uh-huh.
Schiller was a guy, yeah. And
yeah,
I mean, these guys, I mean, I fancied myself a pretty bright guy and an intellectual, but I mean,
right.
All of these guys were reading great stuff, you know?
Man, oh man.
I gave them all Ilf and Petrov. They all wanted to know, you know.
Right.
They'd seen the 12 chairs and they wanted to know. And I gave them the other book, The Little Golden Calf, Ilya Ilf and Evgeny Petrov. I mean, they got it.
What a dream.
I mean, what a cast.
Yeah, crazy cast.
And they all were talented beyond their needs.
Uh-huh.
Every single one of them could have done Hamlet.
Right.
Every single one of them, Madeline could have done.
Right.
The Ring cycle, the Wagner. I mean, that's how big her voice was.
Yeah.
She was an opera singer.
God.
And she could do it.
Amazing.
I mean, you know, and Cloris won an Academy Award for serious acting.
Yeah.
You know, then
in High Anxiety,
in the last
too,
picture
she's...
show, that was Cloris.
Right.
You know?
Right. In High Anxiety,
every one
playing
of these,
that nurse.
Right. She came up with the little tiny, faint mustache.
She did?
Yeah.
That was hers?
She came up with that faint
mustache.
That's
hilarious.
She just put a little bit of black. I said, Cloris, I'm detecting, am I wrong? There's a little bit of a mustache. She said, yeah, I want that.
That's brilliant.
And then she came up with these pointy breasts, you know, these big pointed triangle breasts. I mean, just, she was pretty wacky.
Yeah.
But, you know, she'd smack, if you smoked, she'd smack the cigarette right out of your fat. You know,
she would?
She was crazy. I said, Cloris, you're going to get arrested. You can't do that.
Really? She'd just walk around?
She'd walk around. If you were smoking, look out. You know, she'd just smack it out of your face.
How long did you smoke for?
Till I was 40, I think.
So watching you on Dick Cavett, on the old Dick Cavett interviews.
I was smoking.
You were smoking. You handled a cigarette. Like a pro. You were very cool with it.
Yeah. I liked it. I felt, you know.
Yeah.
I felt like a, you know, like William Powell or somebody.
Right, yeah. You just kind of.
In a good movie.
Right.
But I did a lot of work with, there are very few people I wouldn't let everybody interview me, you know.
Uh-huh.
I did very few interview shows. I did Carson a lot because Johnny Carson listened and was a fan.
Right.
And he loved comedy and he loved comics.
Right.
And he listened. Today, you know, Jay Leno is good, but he still waits for the opportunity.
Right.
And so does Letterman. They wait. You know, if you leave a gap, boom, they're there and they can top you.
Right.
Or both of them elicit the audience's support sometimes to have fun with you.
Right.
And Carson never did that.
Interesting.
Carson was simple, almost naive, and he just was like a kid.
Right.
When I knew when I was on and I was doing a Cary Grant story.
Oh,
that
Cary Grant story.
He was just transfixed. He was just like a little kid. And at the punchline, he'd fall. You wouldn't see him. He was behind his desk. You know?
Right. Can you tell that story? Is it too much to go into that story? The Cary Grant story?
Yeah. Well, I'll
there was this. Where were you working at the time? You were working at what studio?
I was doing a movie that never got made.
Oh, okay.
I've done things that never got made.
Really?
Yeah. This one was called Marriage is a Dirty, Rotten Fraud.
I can't believe you did that.
And I was writing it for Marvin Schwartz. I use his name later. May the Schwartz be with you.
Right. Spaceballs.
And he was producing this movie, and I was writing it based on an idea I had about marriage and
right.
whatever. And it wasn't. It was okay, you know.
Yeah.
And I was writing it, and one time I looked out the window, we're at university, I had a little bungalow. I look out the window, it says Granart. I said, what the hell is that, a cereal? Somebody, can you buy that and put milk on it and bananas and, you know? He said, that's Cary Grant's. I said, you're kidding. I said, does he come here? He said, yeah. He said, I said, Cary Grant, the movie star, that good looking with his hair, he comes with the yellow you know, Boutonniere, he comes here? He said, yeah, yeah. I said, when does he come here? He says, well, he usually comes a little before lunch, like 12:30, and he likes to eat at the commissary. He likes cottage cheese. I've seen him eat. So I said, holy, oh, I can't believe it. So he said, I said, well, it's 12:30. In an hour, he'll be here. I mean, it's 11:30. In an hour, he'll be here. At 12:30, he'll be here to eat at 1 in the commissary. He said, yeah, usually. During the week, he says, you know, sometimes he doesn't come on Friday. Said, all right. Well, this is Wednesday. Cary Grant will... On the button, 1 hour, 12:30, no. A Silver Cloud Rolls Royce. A chauffeur gets out and opens the back door. The most beautiful man in the world with chalk-striped dark gray suit with a yellow boutonniere, a yellow tie, and a white shirt, shiny black shoes, and that hair, his hair, combed. Bounds up the stairs, two at a time, and exits into Grand Art.
Right.
I said, be still my heart.
Holy cow.
I got to call my brother Lenny. Yeah. I called my brother Lenny. I said, Lenny, I swear to God, it's Cary Grant. He gave up. I saw him. You know, I mean, he had a tie clip. He had everything you could think of. Yeah. No, I can't get his autograph. That's so good. That's gauche. Yeah. And he said, well, what is gauche?
You know? Right.
So we had these talks. You know?
It means no.
I said, no, I can't. I'm a writer here at right. Universal, you know.
Yeah.
I can't. I got to behave like a pro.
I'm trying to blend.
So anyway. I said, well, maybe I'll see him again tomorrow. You know, I don't know. We'll see what happens. So I'm walking down out of Marvin Schwartz's thing. I'm going to the commissary myself. I've got a magazine that I want to read an article, and I got tucked in, and I'm going.
Yeah.
And I hear behind me, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. You're Mel Brooks. I've got your record.
What?
I said, holy shit. Could it be? Yeah. And I turn around, and it's the chalk stripe suit, and there he is with the shiny shoe. It's Cary Grant.
Oh my God.
I said, you know? He said, yeah. Carl Reiner gave me some of your records, you know? And he says, I play them constantly. I can't, but that's you, isn't it? You're Mel Brooks. I said, don't destroy your, don't talk to me.
You know? Right, get away.
I don't want to, you'll destroy my dreams. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to the commissary. He says, come, can I join you? I said, can you join me? Are you kidding?
Oh, man.
So we go to the commissary together, and sure enough, he has cottage cheese, and I have a tuna fish on whole wheat toast with a sliced tomato. And I have coffee, and he has tea. He has tea. Okay. Tea with a little bit of milk. And we're talking. What's your favorite color? I say blue. I say, what's your yellow? I say, I see. You know, yellow tie.
Right.
You
know. Boutonniere.
He says, well, what's your favorite car? You know? He said, I like a Silver Cloud. I said, I like a Buick. You know?
Right.
I mean, we had to, I said, you know. I said, it's a plebeian meeting royalty. He said, no, I started off lower than you. Believe me, Archie. You know,
wow.
Tell me about the beginning. And we had nice talks.
Wow.
And anyway, we go back. He goes to Grand Art. I go to Schwartz.
Right.
I continue my writing, you know.
Yeah.
The next day, ring. It's for you. It's Cary Grant. You're kidding. Cary, Mel, yo, commissary, lunch, right, boom, bang, da, 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 da. Thursday, hey, Cary, lunch, boom. Every day, and we're skipping. We're holding hands and skipping together. I mean, we can't get enough of each other. We're madly in love, you know. And then finally, comes Friday, the next day, comes Friday, and the phone rings. I said, if it's Cary Grant, I'm not in. I had run out of all kinds of, I didn't know what to say.
Enough of this guy.
I didn't have any dialogue left, you know. But that's a lie, really. It's a good punchline.
It's a great punchline, hiding under your desk.
I remember.
Get rid of this guy. You're listening to Come to Papa, and I am Tom Papa, and I am laughing because that's what you do when you're in the office of Mel Brooks. I really, when I look at you, and like when I see you in interviews and your work, it seems to me like you've really enjoyed yourself. Is that true?
You know, I've been very lucky, man. Most people work because they need money and they have to make a living. But mm-hmm. I work because even if they didn't pay me, mm-hmm. I'd probably be doing the same things that I've done.
Wow.
You know?
That's really great.
Even if there was no money in it.
Wow. Yeah, because it really seems like you enjoy yourself.
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, it's
did you have career anxiety at any point, or were you just...
At every point.
At every point. What keeps you going? Fear keeps me going.
Well, it's in the 2,000-year-old man, right?
Right.
He says, what, you know, what was the main means of transportation 2,000 years ago? Fear.
Fear.
You know? Keep you moving along, singing a song, right. But I didn't... I'm not sure, you know, but mm-hmm. I really have... You know, I like comedy.
Yeah.
I like, you know, I like comedy so much. I mean, I'll tell you secrets.
Okay.
It's not necessarily breaking up an audience or making an audience laugh or enjoying the ego trip or the power of, you know, mm-hmm. putting an audience, you know, in the aisles.
Right.
Sometimes Carl and I do things that are rather insane, really insane. We do them. Right. We do them for the love of comedy, the art of comedy.
Right.
I'll be alone with Carl. And once he took a cigar band, just me and him, off a cigar, and he put it on his finger to look at it.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, that's a gorgeous ring. That feels beautiful. Right. He said, it's not really a ring. It's from the cigar band. I said, no. I said, it's too beautiful. It's a real, I mean, it's gold. It's red, red and gold and blue. It's gorgeous. It must be a real ring. He says, it's not. It's paper. I said, it can't be. How could anything that beautiful be, you know? And we'd argue, you know, about the thing. And finally, he took it off and he showed it to me.
Right.
And I said, oh, my God, it's paper. You know, we play this scene,
right.
Maybe take a half an hour,
because
we like the whole idea of this person falling in love with the ring, you know.
Right.
And one time, he was teaching me, and it was pretty funny, to speak French, but not really French, to teach me. He's teaching me to speak with a French accent. You know?
Right.
So when you're France, he says, it's close enough.
Right.
They'll really...
Just do it in English.
He says, when you say, here, the chin. I said, the chin. He said, not the chin. The chin. He said, C-H-Z-T-I-N. You know, the chin. I said, okay, the chin. He said, you got it, the chin. The cheek, the cheek. He said... I said, the cheek. No, the cheek. The cheek, the cheek. You want to be, they won't understand you if you say cheek, you know. So then we went on, and then he said, he pointed, you know, below my eye, and he said, the eye, the eye, the eye. And I said, no. And he said, no, what do you mean, no? The eye. Pronounce after me. I said, it's not the eye. He said, it is the eye. That's how you say that. I said, no. I said, it's right below the eye. This is the eye. And I stuck my finger in my eye. I blinded myself. And he fell down.
Just to make him laugh.
Yeah, just to make him laugh. And we did that. Believe it or not, we did that for each other.
Just all the time.
Yeah, because we just...
Which is what you did with 2,000-year-old man for 10 years.
Yeah, we enjoyed it, you know.
Right. It's really great. And it really shows. I mean, it shows in all of your work. And it shows in him, too. You know, I was talking with him.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's a big kid.
He's the greatest ad-lib big kid guy.
God.
I mean, he does the Directors Guild. You know, right. He's 89. He did it at 88 and a half or 89. I don't know. He did the Directors Guild.
Every year.
As the MC. I mean.
He says he doesn't prepare for it either. He just walks in. And
he never prepares.
Yeah.
Whatever is happening, he will incorporate.
Right. Just funny.
He's just amazing.
Is he your closest comedy friend?
Oh yeah, he's my closest friend in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Are you think you and I are going to be close now?
Never. Never. You're so far from Carl Reiner. I don't want to be insulting, but I can't help it. You know? No, Tom, you're good. Tom Papa. Where'd you get that name? Is that Greek?
That's Italian.
How could it be Italian?
Sicily.
Papa. Spell it.
P-A-P-A. Papa. It means Pope.
Oh, you know.
It means Pope in Italian. Pope.
Oh, two P's would be Greek.
Yeah, no.
Two P's would be
P-A-P-P.
Greek.
Yeah, P-A-P-P. I had a limo driver, old Greek guy, pick me up at an airport, and he says, you're Greek.
Yeah.
I said, no, it's P-A-P-A. It's Italian. He says, no, you're Greek.
Yeah.
I said, no, I'm Italian.
That's like calling me.
Yeah, he said, where are you from? Yeah. And I said, where? I said, Sicily. we had it first. You are Greek.
Yeah. We had it for sure. They did own Sicily.
I know.
Then the Italians,
but if you go all the way.
So you're really Greek.
If you go that far back,
yeah.
We all come to the same family.
So were your father and mother born in America?
Yes.
But they came from grandparents?
Grandparents, some that were born in Italy, and then I think one was born here.
Yeah, and, Rudy, his parents actually came from Messina, which is in Sicily.
Yeah.
And so I say, you're a real animal. You know that. You know, I mean, you're so primitive, you know. I said, it's true. You know, he's the funniest guy that ever lived. Rudy DeLuca was the jaws, the stainless steel teeth in High Anxiety.
Right.
He played that guy.
Right.
He played him for real.
Yeah.
And he played him with a little, he had a kind of strange drink with a little umbrella in it, threatening to kill. I mean, yeah. To choose an umbrella, you know, a little umbrella in a drink. I mean, he is so creative and so bright. And he played J. Paul Getty in Life Stinks when I said, no, you're really a poor, diminished, demented, you know, whilst I am really a billionaire.
Right.
I have $5 billion. And he said, I got six. And, you know, and it leads to slapping each other. And it's really, it was really, he's very, Rudy is amazingly funny.
I'm going to take a guess. That when you talk about Cloris Leachman with the little mustache and his little choice with the thing, there's something probably about being around you and knowing that you're at the helm of this ship that gets everybody a little crazy in their heads and they start making these choices.
Yeah.
Right?
I think
just
so.
Being around you makes you want
to be
funny.
Maybe they want to go further.
Right.
You know, maybe they think they don't have to be as, you know, just crowd-pleasing.
Right.
Maybe they can go past crowd-pleasing into real comedy,
you
know?
Because you've pushed and done so many things, you feel like, I'm not going to get as far as he does anyway, so I can try some things.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's possible, but, you know. I always believe we should. I saw a lot of black kids trying to find Cary Elwes trying to find a sidekick in Robin Hood, a character by the name of Achoo, A-C-H-O-O.
Right.
And I saw a couple of kids, and they were all good, and two or three were really good. And then there was this kid, Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
And I said, he's not only funny, there's a humanity and a sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
And that combination, like Richard had, like Pryor had,
right,
the greatest stand-up comic that ever lived,
yeah,
because of his humanity.
Right.
And Dave would go further. He would go further in his show. And I think that's why he had a nervous breakdown or decided. Because he went further. He thought. He just was not a crowd pleaser.
Right.
Neither was Richard Pryor.
Right. No, they're doing it for themselves.
They're doing it for something real.
Right.
Richer than just getting a laugh. You know?
Right. Right.
I often say, why am I doing this? Am I trying to make God laugh? Am I trying to make myself?
Mm-hmm.
Really, instead of just pleasing the crowd, trying to break myself up? And I'm impossible.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know, but I mean, it's a curious question, you know,
yeah,
about why you go further in comedy than just this girl was so skinny, the maitre d' said, check your umbrella.
You think it's going to work?
Yeah.
Right.
The stuff you know that will work.
Right.
And you've got to do the comedy that's questionable, that's dangerous,
right,
that may work and may just fall on its face, you know.
Right.
And that's what really
is it difficult in film because there's no audience there? Like, I could do that in stand up and know immediately whether
it's very difficult in film because you have no idea. But I had a system. I have the white handkerchief system. The white handkerchief system.
Uh-huh.
What are you saying, Mel? I'm saying that I'd buy 100 white handkerchiefs and give them to the crew.
Right.
And I'd say, instead of laughing, because I don't want you to spoil the take,
right,
shove a white handkerchief and shove this handkerchief in your mouth. And then in the middle of a scene, I would turn, I'd see 100 white handkerchiefs, I mean, it's working.
Oh, really?
You know? I know, okay, we're on the right track here, you know? And then I'd do in the middle of a scene, I'd see no white handkerchiefs, I'd say, cut. Then we gotta think about this. You know.
Well, this has been really great. And let me plug once again that tonight on HBO on September 9th is Mel Brooks and Dick Cavett together again at 9 o'clock, where it's a great interview again with, yeah. with
he's
with
very
Dick Cavett.
He's really very funny. Of course, I'm
yeah,
bad.
He
I'm,
is.
I'm
he's much, dry.
I'm much better.
You're much
but,
funny.
But he's, no, but he's, no, I'm seriously, he is surprisingly dry, not yeah. only for a Gentile, but for a comic. Right. He's surprisingly dry and incredibly more than witty. I
right.
mean, there are big, big,
smart.
dirty belly laughs.
Yeah, really?
He's really funny, and I don't break up easily, and he broke me up 3 or 4 times badly.
Oh,
know?
It's amazing.
It's a good night.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. And Carl's there. Carl shows up in the
Carl
audience.
Is there. Carl does 10 minutes, starting with, are you asking me to tell you the genesis of the 2,000-year-old man?
Right.
Suddenly becomes, I don't know why, he becomes very Shakespearean. When, you know,
he got dramatic.
You know, I know. He loves acting. You know? Well, anyway, Tom, this has been nearly fun and nearly good. And that's good enough for me.
Well, I know you don't give away these interviews very easily.
No, I don't. I really
and
don't.
And I know you don't.
And I like you, and I like your show, and I love Georgie, and you know, George Shapiro. And
To be just in the area of comedy and to be sitting here at your desk here in your office is, it's
well, you know, how bad
amazing.
Can your show be if Jerry Seinfeld right. kind of helped create it,
yeah.
you know, and if,
yeah.
if he thought of it,
yeah.
how bad can it be, you know? Sometimes it can be very bad.
Sometimes it's
bad. But most of the time, I know with the right editing, it's wonderful. It's you know, you got to edit a lot. To
yeah,
get, what do you do? Do you do an hour to get the half hour?
It's an hour.
It's
show.
An hour. Do you
so
do,
we do
2 hours?
About an hour. No, we do like an hour 20. First season, we did a lot more. But then the editing was just a bear.
Yeah.
So we try to get it as close to time. So maybe like 15, 20 over. And
it's pretty good, you know?
Yeah, and keep it going. Keep it
do you
moving.
Ask for people? Do you try to get like people like Ellen DeGeneres or somebody, you know? Do you
yeah,
try,
yeah.
You should try to get...
Next season is what I really want to do is have all comedians.
Yeah.
A lot of comedians. I mean, I like other people, but... You know, you stare at some singer and they're looking at you and
yeah,
you're
I know.
Comedy gold. And it's,
I know, you're absolutely right.
It's
you
tough.
Know, celebrity is not good enough. They got, you know,
you gotta
singing.
You got to be a comedian.
Yeah.
You
the
know,
worst thing
desperation.
You, the worst thing you can get is a Latin dancer. First, I don't speak English that well.
I had one.
And yet, really?
Yes.
I mean, a celebrity and everybody knows the guy and he's great, but you know, but yeah. he has nothing to say about, you know, who's right, the woman, the
nothing.
Wife, or the, you know.
A joke about anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And anything about anything.
Yeah, but usually it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I like, you know.
Oh, thank you.
I like that you actually go to the trouble of making the billboard with the person on it
right.
saying, I won the, you know.
Right.
I think it's so bizarre, you know.
Oh, that's good.
But I like it.
Well,
anyway,
thank you very
this,
much. Well,
this,
thank you for...
Like I said,
yes.
thank you. This was nearly good. Nearly fun.
I appreciate that.
You know,
that's all I could hope for.
Tom, pleasure to
thank
pleasure,
you, Mel.
Pleasure to
really
be.
Wonderful.
Okay. Take
thank
care.
You so much.
Right. Bye-bye.
Well, there it is. Another awesome interview. For more, subscribe to SiriusXM at SiriusXM.com. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time. Come to Papa.